Government will now come to order, and we will announce our order of events here. For those of you who have not seen the sign-up sheet or have not seen the expanded agenda listed outside, HJR 28 is number one, followed by House Bill 2757. In the third slot today will be HJR 35. Fourth slot will be House Bill 3172. Fifth will be House Bill 2724. Sixth will be House Bill 2725. And in the last slot will be House Bill 2964. So with that said, we will open a work session on HJR 28. And Representative Sunseri, please. Been just a while since we have visited this issue, and if you would bring us up to speed, we'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Ron Sunseri, State Representative, District 22. If I could bring up a couple of folks from Gresham, because certainly we can do a real minute. And John Lighthouser. Just a quick overview for the committee, Mr. Chair, on HJR 28. The dash two amendments are what we'll be working with, and very simple explanation. What this will allow is a new county to be formed with less than 400 square miles, which is the present requirement. And it will also require that the county that is being formed have 100,000 population, and that the county that remains has 100,000 population. And that essentially is what the constitutional change would be.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Would you care to make any statements?
Mr. Chair, committee, I want to thank you for hearing the bill, getting this up. This is our second try, and hopefully this will be the successful try.
Right.
This is merely an option which is available. None of us are pouring tea into Johnson Creek or anything. We're not fomenting a revolution. We just need another option available. Should Portland and Multnomah County choose to look at consolidation like they did 2 years ago? Frankly, it was very frightening to the public official. The council is unanimous behind supporting this, and we're also unanimous in that we're not going to go out and form a new county the day after this becomes law.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I have a copy of a letter from the city council that I'll distribute to the committee that actually states that there's not something that they're going to be aggressive on and attempt to be proactive, but it's something that they would like in the event that this takes place. So I'll provide that to the committee.
All right, very fine. All right.
Then did you want a quick overview on 2757?
Let's not do that quite yet. Okay. All right, any questions? All right, thank you very much.
Are we in work session, Mr.
Yes,
Chair?
We are.
I would move HJR 28 to the floor. No. I guess we need to move the dash 2.
Sure, sure.
I would move the dash 2 amendments into HJR 28.
Representative Starr moves the dash 2 amendments into HJR 28. Is there any discussion? Clerk?
Atkinson?
Yes.
Beck?
Yeah.
Bowman?
Yes.
Decker? Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson?
Yes.
Wilson?
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
I'd move HJR 28 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Starr moves HJR 28 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? All right. Clerk, please.
Atkinson?
Yes.
Beck?
No.
Bowman?
Yes.
Decker?
No.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson?
No.
Wilson?
Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Sunseri, would you carry it? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. We will close the work session on HJR 28, and we will move into a work session on House Bill 2757. And Representative Sunseri, would you reassume the chair, please?
Sounds like my fraternity.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative District 22, and this is a companion bill to HR 28 that will work with the election portion of this, and I'll just turn it over to Representative Gresham to quickly go over this.
Thank you. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I'm sorry about that earlier. John Lighthouser. I'm with City Council in the City of Gresham. This bill is a companion bill. Basically, any areas seeking should HGR 28 become put in the Constitution, it will allow the areas leaving to be the ones to form together, put the petition forward, and to have the vote to do that. And so that way that should this be necessary, if Portland, Multnomah County is doing the consolidation, we have our own options and ability. And like I said earlier, we're not planning to leave. Nobody's packed their bags.
Thank you. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've shared my concerns with Representative Sunseri and with the mayor and with anybody else who will listen to me about this particular bill. My concern on this bill is that the county that's going to be most directly impacted by any change, their ability is eliminated to have any vote on the say if, in fact, a portion of that county decides to go off and create their own new county. And Representative Sunseri and I talked today trying to figure out how we could make it fairer so that everybody would have an opportunity to participate in a vote. And unfortunately, we were not able to come up with anything that that we could agree would make the most sense. And so based on that, I cannot support this particular piece of legislation because it's going to have a major impact on the county that's left behind. And whether you do it today or 10 years from now, that impact will still be there. And those people have every bit as right to have an impact on what's going to happen to their county that's left as those of you who may want to go off and form your own county.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a response to that, without taking a lot of time, I understand that it is a dilemma and that the legislature can't fix everyone's problems. But in this particular situation, the population of the city of Portland is many, many times larger than that of the city of Gresham and its surrounding areas. And the fact would be that that if they chose to do this and we were not able to vote, we would be completely denied self-determination. It would never be a possibility when you're talking about a population of 70 to 80,000 as opposed to a population of hundreds of thousands. We would be locked into this indefinitely. And so if it is the city of Portland and the county that attempt to make the change, then this will allow the city of Gresham to have a response. And if we don't have this in place, then we absolutely have no response and no hope. So that's the reason I think this is essential and that we are able to provide for the local municipalities to be able to have some self-determination.
Thank you. Further questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sutton.
I move House Bill 2757 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Starr moves House Bill 2757 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Representative Thompson.
Mr. Chair, I've seen this same situation where people are dissatisfied with what's developed. We have a situation on the coast where a lot of people feel it because of the underfunding of roads, underfunding of schools, underfunding of the things that many times, and somewhat jestingly, but not all jest, people say that the coast should secede from the state of Oregon and put up toll bridges coming into the area and pay for the taxes that way. I don't believe that's the right way to do business. I think that we need to try to work together to accomplish things for good for everybody. So I think that I wouldn't want to see a split off in another county, so I'd probably oppose this.
All right, thank you, Representative Thompson. Further discussion? I have a motion on the floor from Representative Starr that House Bill 2757 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. No further discussion. Clerk, please.
Atkinson?
Yes.
Beck?
No.
Bowman?
No.
Decker?
No.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson?
No.
Wilson?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2757 will be carried by Representative Sunseri. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2757. And we will open a work session on HJR 35. Get my paperwork together here. Representative Harper, would you care to address the Dash 8 amendments of HJR 35, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. As a result of the hearing through the original bill, we've all the way up through the Dash 8, Dash 8, just briefly, we've restricted the appropriations to the general fund only, twice the average annual percentage change in the state's private sector income as opposed to payroll, and then the same distribution that we had in the original. So that's really the major change that we got back from our testimony.
Thank you. Do we have some discussion?
I have a question.
Representative Decker.
Should I direct them at Representative Harper?
Sure.
Okay. My question is, I just found over and over at town halls and on the campaign people upset at the number of issues we refer to the ballot. I just heard that over and over and over again, that we seem to not take up our task here and that we refer things to the ballot, and they wish we would do our jobs and not send things to the ballot. And just would, before voting on this, would like to understand why we need to send another thing to the ballot.
Those are great comments, Representative Deckert. If the governor would sign these bills, we wouldn't have to do some of the statutory things. This is a constitutional amendment, so that's why it has to go.
Can I ask one more?
Go ahead, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any sense, Representative Harper, how many items we might be putting on this ballot on the next general election, or how many total referrals we might contemplate making this session?
I don't, just in general, there's a list. I think a total combined list of 20 some odd. That's like there are 4,000 bills printed out of those. I'm sure it'll be down to a handful. And then whether they come this November, next May, or in the general, we don't know yet. But that's some.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Harper, can you explain why the change was from private sector payroll to private sector income?
Private sector income is the standard method data element that we use today with the current statute, that 1979 statute. That's what we use today. So it was just consistent with how we've been doing it for 20 years. I thought that would be simpler and easier for the system to accommodate. And that's published, published easily available. I said it's just something we've been using for a long time.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair, clarifying question. Is that how we calculate now the kicker amount?
Correct.
And it's based on private sector income,
mm-hmm.
not payroll?
Correct.
If I could ask one last follow-up, Mr.
Go ahead,
Chair.
Please.
Why are we tying it to 5 calendar years as compared to biennial?
The biennial, the history that we looked at, it was a little more cyclical. This will give us a little bit smoother ramp. It could be 2, it could be 10. It just 5 was just a number that smoothed it out somewhat. 2 years seemed to me that it was too erratic. That's all.
Any further discussion? Representative Beck.
Yeah, I would like some help understanding this chart. Maybe staff can help us, or maybe sponsors can help us.
Can we call Paul Warner?
Or, call Paul Warner. I don't know.
You guys chat. I'll call him.
What's the question?
Well, I just would like to explain what all that means. 5-year average change, I guess that's pretty clear. The general fund above limit, was that how much the general fund would have been allowed to grow in those biennium?
Yeah.
We have it
in the 2001-2003, which is the one we're talking about.
Mm.
This limit would be a 10.8% allowable growth.
And then what's this last column on the right? The 300.
This is revenues projections.
That's what we'd have.
Yeah, that's the
303 or the 267. What are those? That's the excess?
That's what they project would be returned to the taxpayers.
That would be returned.
Assuming that revenue, on that revenue projection. That's just a 10.8% rate of growth.
Mm-hmm. What was I going to say? Mm-hmm. You want to ask him?
Sure. I mean, I think that Representative Harper seems to answer one of my, I guess another question I have is what... Mr. Chair, what do you do when you have a situation where the surplus, for whatever reason, is only $5 million or something? We have to give that back to the voter.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the Constitution, we can't choose statutorily to keep the $5 million, so we'd have to go to the expense of writing a check, $5 million distributed equitably throughout the state, and whether that is good public policy or... If we just tip right now with the tipper, with the kicker, we've got a 2% buffer. When it's over 2%, we have to write the check, and that's usually going to be a substantial amount of money and worth the state's while. But under this bill, if the surplus or the extra is marginal, we still require to go to the trouble of writing, you know, a 3-cent check, conceivably, to the citizen. Is that right, or am I missing something here?
Government works in strange ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, this is serious. I mean, all joking aside, this is a constitutional amendment, and you can joke about it, but I take putting information in the language of the Constitution very seriously. And I guess that's the other question. Why would you not choose to put something like this in statute so that future legislatures can address new circumstances, economic dynamics we can't forecast today. Voters keep complaining that you aren't solving our problems in Salem. And we, Senator Adams, on numerous occasions says, well, our hands are tied because the voters have placed all these measures in the Constitution, implying that maybe we should try to keep more of these financial measures in statute so that our hands aren't tied, so that we can make needed alterations. I guess I'm wondering about constitutional advisability of putting something this dramatic in the Constitution and further complicating an overly complicated Constitution.
Mr. Chair Rosenbeck, it's because, you know, sooner or later, and I know this is a remote possibility, but we may not be in control. The Democrat legislature overrode the 1979 statute several different times. 10.8% is a healthy amount. And we can make this thing work.
Hmm. Thank you for the discussion.
Pretty simple.
Representative Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howard, I just had a question on that point, and not to belabor this in any sense, but... In the context of this session, where you are in control, we could conceivably just cut these budgets and present a full budget to Oregonians and say, this is our vision and this is the budget that we think is most appropriate. Therefore, we would not ask you to tamper with the Constitution of Oregon, but rather, here is our budget and we think this is the appropriate budget for the state of Oregon. We could do that. That would be one route.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, just can you give me 31 votes?
You're not the majority leader of, unfortunately, I'm not the majority leader in terms of rounding up votes. I did have one.
Representative Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why was this route the preferred route rather than simply putting forth a budget, which we haven't received yet? Why was this the preferred route and not simply putting forth a budget and saying, we think this is the appropriate expenditure and the appropriate budget for the state of Oregon for the next biennium?
Will the governor sign that?
That's just
the democratic
process that we've set up.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Representative Sinceri.
Just comment on Representative Beck's concern. HR 35 does not determine how the money is returned, and I suppose then that the legislature can make that determination. If it's just a matter of 3 cents, we could make it a credit on their income taxes, or we could send it back the following time. it doesn't say how it's going to be returned to the people. So there's some latitude there on part of the...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you. Representative Beck made me think of another question. Representative Hopper, I would be very supportive of a bill that limited our ability to go into bonded indebtedness. And what I see, we're going down this track where rather than actually raising revenue to pay for services, we're more willing to go out and do some kind of bonding to borrow against the future like we did last session for education, for a two-year education budget. We went out for a 10-year lottery-backed bond. And so my question is there a companion bill that would prevent government from actually going into debt into the future so that we're not, rather than being responsible and spending revenue we have today, which is I think where you're trying to get us to, that we don't end up down this route where we're depending on lottery for the next 50 years to pay for 2 years' worth of education or other necessary state services. So I haven't seen it yet, but I'm wondering if there's one forthcoming that would deal with the other side, which is let's not go into debt to pay for things we should pay for today.
I don't know, but I would be happy to co-sponsor with you.
Well, we should talk about that because I think that's
be there.
The problem that we're headed towards.
Yes, thank you. Representative Sunseri.
Well, Mr. Chair, while we're discussing this, I think the facts are that what Representative Bowman has just said is an important part of this. That's part of the reason that we want to limit how much money the state can actually take in, because we seem to have the ability to spend everything, whether it's Democrats or Republicans. And the people, I think, are getting tired of that. We have a constitutional amendment that mandates that we balance our budget. Well, we might balance that $10 billion. It's the other $20 billion in COPs and other bonded indebtedness that we're not balancing, that we're trying to get at. We'll say, this is how much money you can take in, so you can't spend any more than that. And I think we've got to address that. And I think it's also important that the legislature begin to realize that if we don't do some things like that, even if we send it out to the people for their approval, we're going to end up with another Measure 5 that's going to be very difficult for the legislature to deal with when the people finally decide that they're going to solve the problem that we're not going to solve. So I think this is an approach that that has merit and will also solve the problem.
Thank you. Any further discussion?
No.
All right, we would drop it. We'll take a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
I'd move the Dash 8 amendments to HJR 35.
Representative Starr moves the Dash 8 amendments into HJR 35. Any further discussion? Clerk, call the roll, please.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. I would like to say some comments.
Go ahead.
I can't think of any piece of legislation that makes me more embarrassed to serve in this legislative body. It's really it's hard coming down here. I come from a constituency of very informed people and very educated, highest voter turnout in the state, very active constituency. And it's tiring going home and having them just shake their heads and thank me for doing what I'm doing, but being a part of a piece of legislation like this makes me really question why I expend any energy. This bill goes against our Republican form of government, representative government, where people elect us to make tough decisions. And this bill takes away our ability to act as representatives of the people. I guess equally troubling is that this is as divisive and as partisan a bill as I've seen come before this session. The public is demanding to us that we start working out our issues with the governor, with the other party, have more bipartisan negotiations going. The best legislation in Oregon has always been bipartisan. Governors were involved and people from both parties were involved. And I think this bill is rather than trying to work something out with the governor, to put something like this in statute would make a lot more sense. But instead, we're just going off to put it in the Constitution, which I think is a grave, grave mistake for the people of Oregon. Finally, I just think this is the most cowardly bill I have seen come before this session. We don't have the courage to sit down, work out issues like this. We don't have enough confidence in our public institutions and future representatives that we have to pass this piece of cowardly legislation and put this kind of absurd limitation into our already overly cluttered state constitution. I'm going to vote no, and I will be working to raise this issue in front of the people of Oregon in the next few weeks, I guess.
Thank you, Representative Beck. Further comments? All right, we have a motion that the Dash 8 amendments be moved into H.J.R. 35. No further discussion. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Yes.
Beck?
No.
Bowman?
No.
Deckard?
No.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson?
No.
Wilson?
Aye. Dash 8 amendments are moved.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move H.J.R. 35 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Atkinson, pardon?
I think this will start for all the ways and means.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you would add that to your motion.
With a subsequent referral to ways and means.
Representative Atkinson moves H.J.R. 35 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to ways and means. Discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share the concern of my colleagues on this council about our continuous use of the Constitution to do things that we are empowered by the people who voted for us to do. My biggest concern is the way this resolution is worded. Unless you've got a lot of accounting background, you would have no idea what it is you're voting on. And again, as representatives of the people, it would be nice if we were going to send this to the public that it was a lot cleaner and a lot more understood by the general public. In addition to that, I'll reiterate my earlier concerns. This talks about limiting government spending, but it does absolutely nothing to stop us from getting further and further into this lottery-backed bond indebtedness. It does nothing about the COP bonds that we continue to do because we refuse to raise the resources necessary to pay for basic government services. And so I think what we're doing is we're sending people a smokescreen. We're telling them we're here for you and we're going to help you limit government. At the same time, we continue to go out and expand the lottery and expand the ability to get bonded indebtedness for basic government services. I believe this is really a disservice to the people of Oregon, and I believe that we will live to regret the action that this committee is taking today.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Well, my colleagues have expressed themselves well, and I said I'd be more sensitive on this issue because I've been fairly aggressive in my opposition. But I'm worried again. We see a situation that I see many times in my own industry. That's where people limit themselves either by lack of maintenance in the boat or by lack of funding in the boat, and you wind up getting yourself in trouble when you get heavy weather and poor times, and that's exactly what I see this doing. In the future, when the state of Oregon gets in hard economic times, we've limited ourselves as to the options we have to generate revenue. I have no problem with if we go to this body and we say no to something. But when we put this in the Constitution, we put no there for any future circumstances that develop. And what happens with fishermen who get in the ocean in those kind of storms is they drown. And if we go into severely hard times, I'm afraid we've put our education system and many needy people in the state of Oregon as the drowning people in the future.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Further discussion, Representative Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll thank my friend from Klamath Falls and others for bringing forth the bill, though I disagree with it, or a resolution, though I disagree with it. It certainly brings conversation and dialogue, which is always healthy, and I think is the meaning for this place. And so I think it is a good discussion. I guess my concerns are two-part. One, in terms of referring, and I would just ask my colleagues that we be very, hopefully, sensitive to what I think is the voters' wishes, that we limit ourselves in terms of referral and changing the Constitution. And I guess that brings me to the second point, which is working with a democratically elected governor who, I know he got much larger percentage of vote than I received and probably many of my other colleagues in the legislature. And I think we would be well served to, as much as possible, work together and demonstrate that to the citizens of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Have a motion on the floor. And clerk, would you call the roll, please?
Atkinson?
Yes.
Beck?
No.
Bowman?
No.
Deckert?
No.
Harper?
Aye.
Jarre?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Yes.
Thompson?
No.
Wilson?
Aye. HGR 35 carries. All right, we'll close the work session on HGR 35. And we will open a public hearing. Is Representative Witt here?
Yes, sir.
Oh, thank you, sir. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3172. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 3172 is designed to correct a, what I think is a new area of policy by one particular park and recreation district that assesses systems development charges on employers within their area based upon the hiring of employees. And from what I'm told, this is the only government entity in the state of Oregon that imposes a systems development charge specifically on an employer, specifically for hiring an individual. And that's been brought to my attention in the last few months by complaints from businesses within my district. And I think that we need to have some clear legislative direction on that. Systems development charges, as I'm sure all of you know, are primarily imposed upon new construction to assess costs that are necessary to cover certain government services. I believe this is the first time where it has been specifically assessed on the employment relationship. So House Bill 3172 is designed to correct that and say that the state of Oregon does not approve of and it is not lawful to impose systems development charges on employers simply on the employment relationship. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Sure, thank you. Could you give us the specific case that has actually caused this?
Yeah, I think they're here to testify. It's Tualatin Hills Park and Recreation District is now assessing a charge on employers who have businesses within the district when they hire new employees. And I think the charge is somewhere, it was either 60 or 90-some dollars. It has nothing to do with construction or a new facility or a new home or anything like that at all, where traditionally that's where systems development charges have been imposed, but simply from hiring someone. And as an employer, you know, I know that I hire employees who live in Vancouver, Washington, who live in Salem, Oregon, who live all over the greater area, but simply by hiring someone now, you pay a charge to assist these special districts in terms of their costs and their development of facilities. And I'm told that this is probably the only place in the state where this is occurring.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. Further questions, Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Witt, do any of these employees use the services of the special district?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Starr, of course I wouldn't know because we're talking about thousands of employees. You know, traditionally, I think it's typical that people use services close to where they reside. And traditionally, it's been like when you build a new home or you do a new subdivision, that's where you impose the system, the development charges. That, to me, is a more appropriate and direct relationship than assessing it flat on employees. I can tell you in my own case, I've got employees who live in Cougar, Washington, and Vancouver, Washington, and Salem, Oregon, who work out of my office. And based upon this imposition of this fee, no matter where the employee resides, you're paying the charge.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Witt, Are you sure that it's a systems development charge that they're charging?
That Representative Bowman, that is my understanding, yes.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair, it was my impression that system development charges are for new developments. And so when you're in the process of developing a new development, you determine what the system development charges are at that time. And so it sounds like if this is the case, and of course we haven't heard from the people who are impacted yet, that's not the appropriate use that this particular entity is using it for. I mean, that's not what a system development charge is.
Representative, I couldn't agree with you more. And specifically here in the language in Section 2, Paragraph 3, it says that to impose a systems development charge on an employer, it must be with regard to new construction or new development by the employer. But that's not what's occurring here. It's being imposed simply by hiring the employee. So I agree with your interpretation as the purpose of the systems development charge. And I think this method of imposing this fee goes beyond that.
Representative Beck.
I guess I'll look forward to hearing from the Park District, but maybe from your perspective, you were active in this thing we just passed out that was originally based on limiting growth based on payroll growth. So it was sort of trying to limit state government based on private sector growth. And I'm wondering whether if a local community decides that part of the way we want to assess fees to accommodate our growth, we want to base it on private sector, in this case, number of employees, why that wouldn't be an appropriate way, given your support of HJR 35, why it wouldn't be a appropriate way to account for growth in a community versus, say, at a statewide level.
Yeah, well, Representative, I'm here to testify on this bill, of course, but the reason I think it's inappropriate is the reason that Representative Bowman just inferred. Systems development, you know, traditionally and rationally is tied into new development, new construction, not into hiring an employee. So, I mean, I'd like to speak specifically to that issue, you know, at this point in time. In terms of what local governments do, they have certain latitude under the law in terms of where they can impose fees and taxes and where they can't. This bill simply says systems development charges should not be based upon the employment relationship per se without some kind of development or construction involved in the process.
The irony is lost, apparently.
Maybe not.
Maybe not.
So the questions? Representative Witt.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Call up the three from the Tualatin Hills Park and Recreational District. If you'd please state your name and begin. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Don Gaynor. I'm a Don Gaynor and Associates in Beaverton. I'm a consultant to the Park District on the system development charges. And I guess the first thing I'd like to do is clarify the system development charge that the Tualatin Hills Park and Recreation District recently adopted includes both a residential and a non-residential component, but the fee is only assessed and imposed on the issuance of a building permit. It's only imposed for new construction and new development. And the reason that we came to testify today is that we had some concerns about some of the wording because it wasn't clear to us whether this bill would prevent the district from being able to impose a fee or collect a fee on the act of new construction and new development. The Park District is not alone in collecting fees of this nature. There are several other cities, including Tigard and Wilsonville and Hillsboro, who collect the non-residential parks system development charges. The intent of the bill is that people couldn't impose a fee solely on having someone hired, then the district doesn't have any concern with that. The concern is that if it would prevent the district from collecting a fee when new construction or development occurred by an employer, then the district would have a concern with that.
Mr. Chair, if I may. Sir, the ordinance that you said was passed by the City Council has two separate types of systems development charges. One is non-residential, and what was the other one?
Residential.
Residential.
Correct.
And is there, in fact, now a charge when a new employee is hired by a firm? That's
no.
A systems development charge?
No, there's not.
There is not?
No.
So what we just heard isn't, in fact, not happening in your community?
No, it isn't.
Oh. Okay.
Go ahead.
My name is Jim McElhenney, and I'm on the staff of the Park District. Just to reiterate something Mr. Gaynor said, and just the fact that the Park District does not impose a fee based specifically on new employees. That's a very important point. It is development-related, construction-related. The fee is not imposed until the time a building permit is issued at either the city or the county. Just an important point that we want to make with you here today.
Representative Beck.
Mr. Chair, have you folks talked to Representative Witt?
With every respect to Representative Witt, Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, we did attempt to make contact back and forth the last few days, and Representative Witt did attempt to make a contact with us. Unfortunately, our schedules did not meet.
Well, as far as you know, he is unaware that you do not impose SDCs in this manner.
That's correct.
Yes, sir.
Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment and maybe a suggestion. You mentioned the City of Hillsborough charging SDCs for parks, and that's true, they do. As a former city councilor in Hillsborough, they charge them based on the number of parking spaces, not on the number of employees, which I think is the difference there. It's pretty easy for a business when you're going in for a building permit to say, have their plans and say we have 217 parking spaces. They may not know how many employees that they're going to hire or have in that new facility. I would suggest to the park district that you perhaps change the way in which you assess these kinds of SDCs to get away from this kind of confusion, because what if when the company starts out says, well, we're going to hire 150 people, and they may or may not be able to, they may hire less, they may hire more. It seems kind of, to me, that would be a more solid, concrete criteria by which to assess these SDCs would be actual physical things that you can count on the ground, like the way that Hillsborough does it. Would you care to comment on that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Starr. I apologize for misstating earlier about the City of Hillsborough. When we examined alternative methods for collecting this fee, we looked at using parking spaces as one option. And post the Dolan decision in Tigard, we looked at several other cases and determined that the best link as far as being able to show a benefit with new employment with non-residential development is with basing the fee on employment and number of employees. So we followed the example that the City of Tigard had passed. They passed it after the Dolan decision, and we used their ordinance as a model.
Mr. Chair,
I for one would like to know the answer. I think I'd like to have Representative Witt come back and tell us, and then if we need to have them come back again. I mean, I want to know if they're charging these SDCs based on employers or employees or parking stalls or.
Yeah, I agree.
So let's find out where this is.
We'll do that in a moment. Sir, did you have something you wanted to add to this? And if you'd identify yourself with the record, please.
My name is Steve Bozak, and I'm.